Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Chalkett.
And this is Core Intuition. You should get a lawyer.
Oh, Manton, well, you did the hard part. You submitted Sunlit to the App Store. You rejected it many times.
Yes.
Do you have like a little sign up in your workspace? It has been blank days since a developer reject.
I should. I need one of those. And I haven't gone back. I think that you can see the history, you know, of the version.
Yeah.
In iTunes Connect. I haven't looked at that. I'm scared to look and see how many times I've gone through this process. After we recorded, I'm ashamed to admit I rejected it again.
No.
I totally did. Usually I'm not this bad about this, but I introduced like several bugs literally in the last week. And one of them was a crashing bug and I just couldn't stand it. And so I fixed it. But still, it was submitted Thursday morning, pretty early. And so we're recording Tuesday and it's still waiting for review, but I expect that it will be either approved or rejected today or tomorrow, I guess so.
What's the review times from Shiny Development? What do they say?
I think they say 4 days right now, which is great. I mean, that's pretty good.
Uh-huh.
And so it's been about that. I also, on Sunday, I fixed a couple bugs in Tweet Library that I'd been putting off, and I submitted a new version of that, just a minor bug fix update. And that went into review within a few hours. And of course, it hasn't been approved, and I expect it will stay in review for a few days. But it's just one of those weird, you know, what's actually going on behind the scenes in the App Store?
Right.
Who knows?
Well, I had a recent App Store review, I don't know, shenanigans with the Mac App Store because, you know, I submitted a pretty routine Mars edit for the Mac update. I like how I clarify for the Mac as if there was any need to clarify. I was pretty confident about it because I've been doing this thing recently where I basically release, because I got tired of getting burned by, you know, accidentally shipping something in the Mac App Store that turns out to be bad. I switched to a strategy where I no longer strive to simultaneously release for App Store and general public. So these days I usually have like a week or so of public release time before Apple, you know, gets around to approving it. Although that's, you know, getting less, I guess it's 4 days maybe or so, 4 business days, but that can add up to a week or so. And, I was pretty confident this thing was going to fly through. So when they got this email that says your app has been rejected, and to clarify, Manton, I mean, they rejected it, not me.
All right.
And, they say your app has been rejected. I'm still so like psychologically, I don't know, in such psychological bondage from Apple and their approval process that whenever I see an email from the App Store that says your app has been rejected, I kind of get like a panic reaction. I'm like, mm-hmm. I'm like, oh no, oh, this is it. This is the end. They, you know, blog editors are too close to the Finder experience. And, but then of course I go and they make you wait because they make you go through this, like go to the, what do they call it? The resolution center. And then you get to find out what they're actually complaining about. And in my case, they said it crashes at launch. And I'm thinking, it doesn't crash at launch. I've been using this thing. Thousands of users have been using it. And Apple runs it. And it says it crashes at launch. And they're kind enough. So they're very polite. I've noticed they've become very polite. I think they've realized this is one of their secret weapons, you know, how much that helps. So, they send this very polite message, crashes at launch, we tried it twice, it crashes every time, here's the crash log. And the crash log is just totally bogus. It says, mm-hmm. It says there's a missing framework from the app. Okay. And I'm thinking, oh my God, did I really screw this up that badly? Did I screw it up so that my build process, which has been working reliably, no longer copies in one of the app's frameworks?
Mm-hmm.
And I checked, it looked fine, it seemed okay. And then there's this one little subtle thing I noticed that on my Mac, it complained about the version I submitted to the App Store. It complained about the entitlements.
Right.
And it said, you're not allowed to have iCloud entitlements on this thing. I'm like, iCloud entitlements? I don't have any iCloud entitlements. But turns out that I had renewed the provisioning profile for submissions to the App Store. And apparently, you have no choice now about whether or not... Well, no, that wasn't it. Somehow it defaulted to having App Store or iCloud. Anyway, long story short, I found out from Rich Siegel, our friend at Barebones, that Mac apps don't even need a provisioning profile. So if you're not, and it turns, and it turns out, I guess I think I was using a provisioning profile before, but I think maybe it was just so empty, it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. And now, long story short, my app was being signed with a provisioning profile that said it had things like iCloud and keychain sharing.
Yeah.
And apparently the way that Apple interprets that is to say there's a framework missing from the app.
Yeah, so, iCloud. Yeah. So did you have to go through that whole, I don't know how to fix this, I'm going to delete every provisioning profile, everything from my keychain?
I did a lot of that, yeah. And I mean, and then I was discouraged to discover that, like, when I created a provisioning profile again, I learned that there's not even a way, apparently, in the UI to turn off keychain sharing anymore when you create a provisioning profile for the Mac. I don't know if that's a bug or what, but anyway, lots of scratching my head. And of course, you know, the information I got from the start was just that there's a missing framework. So finally figured it all out. And I'm like, I just hope this works because, you know, I submitted it. And thankfully, a few days later, it was approved. So
nice. Well, it's better what you went through than if they had approved it and it crashes on everyone's machines, which I heard a story. I can't remember if it was Tweetbot or there was some app and it was something maybe with push notifications or something where entitlements were wrong and it got by Apple and it went into the store and everyone updated and the app didn't work. I can't remember which app it was.
Oh, that's terrible. Yeah, but yeah, so
that's
bad.
And that's the worst. And because it is, you feel like you're submitting this app, you know, into the void. You can't test it yourself. You don't know exactly how it's going to behave on people's machines. And it's a little bit annoying. I kind of went through a little bit of this a couple of weeks ago. I added push notifications. It was just similar. You know, you have entitlements and such to Sunlit. And I hadn't done this before. And it's fairly straightforward. It's easier than you might think. But there is a lot of this provisioning, you know, process you have to go through. And then you have to have SSL certificates on your, you know, server and everything has to match. And at one point everything was working, but I noticed when I was viewing the certificates, it had the wrong provisioning profile name or private key name or something. You know, everything worked, but it didn't have the same app name that I was expecting.
Right.
Even though the bundle ID and everything was right. And I was like, well, it works. Maybe it's fine. But I was so nervous that maybe something wasn't fine that I just went in and scrapped everything and rebuilt, you know, all the provisioning profiles, uploaded all new.
And somewhere in there, you also developer rejected it, right?
This was before I even submitted it. But sure, yeah, for good measure. But again, and I feel fairly confident that I've got it all right. But it's a little bit annoying when you're just submitting it and you're not actually sure how it's going to work. And I did notice that iTunes Connect does show entitlements. Maybe they've always done this. Maybe I've never noticed it. And you can also, I went through the whole process of, you know, you do a build for the App Store, but you save it as a .ipa file.
Yeah.
And then you rename it zip, and then you know, use CodeSign to verify that everything looks correct. And so, I mean, there's stuff you can do to give you a little bit of more peace of mind, but still the whole process, it's just so frustrating.
Well, you know what's funny, Manton, is I actually have in my Xcode build, you know how you have build phases and you can have script build phases. Mm-hmm. I actually have the very last build phase, and I think this is a good idea. I recommend this for people. It's a build phase called Verify App Store Requirements. And it actually just goes through and does some of this junk, and it like verifies that all the code signing is correct. Well, it did verify that the code signing is correct, but it didn't verify that there were no unexpected entitlements. So I guess I'll have to go in and amend that. But I do think it's a good idea to, anytime you discover something that throws you off like this, have a build phase that that is able to automatically check for this stuff and then add whatever it is, new, whatever new thing you find. It's kind of like a unit test in that sense, right? It just like prevents you from ever having that specific problem again.
Yeah, no, that's good advice. I should probably automate some of this. I think I have shied away from extra build phases because with ClipStart, my Mac video app, before I pulled it from the App Store, it just got out of control with weird build phases that would, you know, if you're building for this, you know, use Sparkle. If not, rename this stuff and copy this framework. And
yeah,
just lots of weird complexity in the build process that I feel like the more complicated it is, the less I trust that everything's going to work, you know, totally smoothly.
Yeah.
All right. So as we're recording today, Glassboard 3.0 was released. And folks who've been listening to the show for a while know we have a Glassboard for Core Intuition. And I thought this would be a good opportunity to talk about it some more, remind people that we have it because we haven't mentioned it in a little while. And the invite code is CoreInt. And you can use that and you can join. And it's been a nice place to get feedback, questions, post stuff about the show.
Yeah, it's great. And we know we've been sort of intermittent about using it. To be honest, Manton, I think one reason I've been a little intermittent about it recently was because the sort of uncertain sense about the future of Glassboard. You know, mm-hmm. It kind of had that like, how much do I want to invest into this if, you know, they had announced that they're looking for a buyer and then you don't know who's going to buy it. You don't know if it's going to be sold or if it's just going to end up being shuttered. So it was really reassuring to me to see that, you know, our friend Justin Williams had bought it and that he is investing so much time into giving it a sort of a relaunch.
Yeah, I think I'm really happy that he's the one that took it over because he also, you know, obviously he's shipped a bunch of apps. We've known him for a while and, you know, he can pull this off. But also he had a great kind of, here's how I would fix Glassboard if I would acquire it, like yeah, 6 months
big
ago.
Big if, right?
Yeah, right. And, you know, it was a nice post, had some good ideas. And then, of course, nothing happens for months. And then it turns out he does pick it up. And so I feel like he had a head start thinking about the app.
Yeah, absolutely. And I heard him recently, as I said last week, I think I heard him interviewed on the Iterate podcast. Mm-hmm. And he was just talking about how, you know, kind of crazy it is for him to take this on. But I remember one of the things he said was this is an opportunity for him to kind of get away from the whole App Store being for one thing, sort of beholden to App Store reviews and sales, right? It's his way of getting into a sort of subscription system. So it's kind mm-hmm. of like along the lines of the way you think, I think, about things. Mm-hmm. But then he was just acknowledging, like, this is kind of scary. It's a big risk for him because Glassboard is just this, you must relate to this so well, Manton, because it's just this big money consuming web service that other people can, at their own whim, other people can add to your monthly expenses, right? Just by adding stuff. Just here, let me just add some stuff to Glassboard and then Justin will have to pay more money this month. But he seems to have a pretty good sense for how he wants to move things forward to get, you know, make premium a big compelling upsell. So,
yeah, and in a lot of ways, he's taking on even more than some of my apps, just because, you know, there's the web version, the iPhone version, the Android version,
right,
actively developed. So he's got, I mean, he's starting with iOS because he knows that the best. But he's been working on Android stuff, and he's going to have to do a new version of that to make those folks happy. So it's there's a lot of work, but I'm excited to see where he takes it. I think it's going to be good.
Yeah, and I'm just so happy that it's going to be around because, you know, it is one of those weird, well, you know, I mean weird in the nicest way. It's one of those weird services where you don't necessarily use it every day. I mean, we might. Hey, folks, if you start getting onto the Core Intuition Glassboard, we might use it every day, keep up with you. Mm-hmm. But generally, I've used it for like conferences and stuff like that. It's really great for conferences. It's like one of its ideal, you know, suited things. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a lot of room for him to grow in that respect. So we'll see. We'll see where it goes. And congratulations, Justin, not only on the acquisition, but on carrying it out to the point where you ship this 3.0 update for iOS. That is, you know, we talked before, Manton, about 1.0s being hard, but any .0 is hard. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. frankly, just getting even a bug fix update out the door is hard. But yeah. Let's be real.
Yeah, how many people buy an app and then you don't hear anything, or they struggle for months and months and months just to be able to do a build?
Yes,
correct, and that has some small changes.
Or you see a bug, you see an update, and you're like, "Oh, this is great! They're finally going to fix those bugs I've been complaining about." And then it says, "New iOS 7 icon."
Gotta start somewhere. Yeah. So he's very quick coming out with this.
He is.
He's obviously worked really hard on it, and yeah, I assume there's a lot to do. I mean, the server backend stuff, I think, is all hosted at Microsoft, I think. And so maybe that's a whole, you know, Azure and all that whole thing is a whole nother learning experience probably to go through.
Yeah, he's got to be just like totally rounding out the skills. if Glassboard doesn't succeed, then he will at least be one of the most rounded engineers I know by the end of this process.
Yeah. Cool. Well, folks, again, the invite code for our Glassboard is coreint. So feel free to join and ask questions or chime in on anything if you have feedback.
Yep. See you over there.
Okay, this week we are happy to have Crashlytics sponsoring the show again. Crashlytics is a crash reporting framework for iOS and Android. You just add it to your app, you make a couple calls, and your crashes go up to Crashlytics server, where you can search them, can organize them, can get information about what version of your app is crashing, where it's crashing, what version of iOS it's running. Really slick web UI and a really nice Mac app for getting started. It walks you through setting up your project. So really easy. It only takes a few minutes to go through and get things set up so that your app is reporting crashes. And it's just a really good idea to do this. So when your app is crashing, you know, on your users' machines, and it never crashes on your own device, never crashes on the simulator when you run it, you actually can get some information about what's going on in the real world.
Yeah, Manton, one of the things I love about Crashlytics is that they help you zero in on the most impactful crashes, and I mean that, of course, in the impactful in a negative way. So, like, if you, you know, ideally, of course, you have no crashes, and then you go to Crashlytics just to, like, feel good about yourself, I guess, every day. But in the real world, where most of us live, our software is complicated in a way that you most likely have some crashes. Now, the problem is, what if you have 10 distinct issues and you don't know which one to work on first? Crashlytics does a lot of work to help you figure that out. And one of the things they do is they have an impact level. So you look at your dashboard in Crashlytics and it floats the stuff that Crashlytics has decided is a higher impact. And I think they do that based on a number of different metrics, but, you know, obviously some of it's like, how many people does this affect? Maybe like what the severity of, I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Looks like what, number of crashes is a big one too.
Maybe like which OS, like I could imagine them saying, hey, if this affects, you know, an OS that has more users on it, then that's speculation. But anyway, that's one, their impact level floats things to the top. They also have other stuff to help you like zero in, like a time frame. So I'm looking at my dashboard now. I can just look at the crashes that have occurred in the last 24 hours. That's like, whatever reason, maybe that is, you know, interesting. You want to know like what's really affecting people today. And then you can also say, I only want to look at open issues, which means, for example, if you have, Manton, if you've like got an issue in Tweet Library that you know you fixed, you committed the code change and you submitted it to Apple, but it's not live yet, you can close that issue in Crashlytics. So you don't have to consider that as something that you are is still on your roster for fixing.
Yep.
So lots of really great ways that really increase your ability to zero in on the crashes you need to pay attention to make the best impression on your customers. Thanks, as always, for sponsoring Core Intuition. Crashlytics, you can find out more at crashlytics.com. All right, folks. Well, we have a tradition here on Core Intuition of the listener Q&A, and we've been neglecting that a little bit recently. I haven't been reminding folks to send in questions as much as we used to, but if you do have questions or suggestions for topics, get in touch with us, feedback@coreint.org. And this week, we do have a question from Brian Yamabe on Twitter, who asks, what do you think of in-app usage analytics? And I guess this is, you know, this is probably more pertinent to iOS. There's a ton of frameworks out there, I think, that do this kind of stuff where basically it's able to tell you things like, I guess, you know, on a specific screen, what do people tap the most? How much of that stuff have you played with, Manton?
You know, not that much, really. And I guess it could mean a range of things. Like you said, it could be really detailed, like where did they click and what exactly are they viewing? Or it could mean more general, like we've talked about, you know, even with crash reporting framework and stuff, you know, sometimes you get a lot of information about what version of the OS they're running and whatnot. But yeah, it does seem like he's really talking about more specifically how they're using the app. And I don't have a lot of experience with that. Some of my apps, I collect a lot of data just by accident because there is a server component. So the app is checking in to get data or checking in for certain actions. You know, in Sunlit, when I register for push notifications, for example, it's on my mind today. I don't know why. I log certain things, so I have an idea of when they took a certain action that would require me to enable that. But I don't have, I haven't used a lot of these frameworks too much. I have my regular job, Vital Source ebook stuff. We did integrate the New Relic. SDK at one point, and it's not in there right now, but I use New Relic on all my web apps for tracking everything about what's going on, you know, hits per second, where errors are, whatever. And they have an SDK for iOS that I thought was really interesting too, because it tracks like all your network connections, like what servers you're hitting, how long it's taking, that kind of thing. But there's a whole bunch of frameworks like that now, and I'm kind of amazed how many are out there.
So how do you balance, how does a developer in general balance or evaluate the question of whether their use of in-app analytics is a privacy concern for the user?
Yeah, I think, so my take would be you shouldn't go totally crazy on this. I mean, I think you can spend a lot of time. It doesn't end up mattering that much, first of all. But if you, there are some, like, some types of information that you're collecting, I think just happen naturally. And, the user knows, you know, that the server, that the app is checking in with the server. And I don't think it should be a big surprise. Just like if you're browsing a website, it shouldn't be a big surprise that they have a log file of everything you're doing. But I think anything where you're collecting a lot of extra information, you know, like where they clicked, what screens they're viewing exactly, that kind of stuff. I think a lot of that should be maybe anonymous or at least mostly anonymous, where you don't necessarily know exactly who is doing that, because it does seem a little bit creepy if you know exactly who is using your app every second and exactly what they're doing in the app.
Right. And for example, I don't even know if this is possible in iOS, but if you were to, say, be able to detect and report every single screen tap, then even if you weren't saying like, oh, they tapped H, they tapped I, they tapped, you know, K, you could theoretically deduce that after the fact by saying, huh, I wonder if all these taps near the bottom of the screen correlate to the standard keyboard layout. I guess that's the paranoid way that I think about this kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's right, though. I mean, and you could, I mean, there's nothing to stop an app from, you know, what's your Twitter password, and then sending that to the server, right? I mean, and that would, that's a clear cut, like that would be terrible. But I think there's a lot of kind of middle ground,
right?
You're sending some, and you hear about all these problems all the time. Path had a couple of these kind of weird privacy things. They're sending your phone book, you know, your contact information up. It's well-intentioned. They want to make the app better, but you hear about these apps all the time that cross the line.
Yeah.
And then people revolt and they just can't stand the fact that the app has been doing this without telling the user at all. All this time.
Yeah, right. As soon as you are recording information from specific users and then transmitting it to your web server and then presumably saving it and, you know, aggregating it, it's like the standard for how careful and paranoid you need to be about what you are collecting goes way, way, way up. It's you know, like there's it's one thing to say, like, well, obviously you want to be careful and secure with the user's data on their phone, But the minute it goes off their phone, it's a whole different ball game because, you know, who knows where that data is going to go? Who knows whose hands it's going to get into? That data could potentially be stored on a server and sold from one company with great intentions to another company with less great intentions. So it's just obviously something that people need to be aware of when they're trying to, even with the best intentions, collect user data. As soon as it goes off that phone, you have to apply a higher standard.
Yeah. I also think with a lot of this, and not just even forgetting about analytics, but just any type, like you said, information that leaves the device, you should probably have a privacy policy these days. And I kind of resisted having one for a while because, oh my gosh, I got to get a lawyer. I mean, who's going to write this thing? And actually, the thing that got me finally over the fence to do this stuff is when I submitted a watermark to the app.net, you know, referral developer incentive program. They required one. It's like, okay, I got to have one. So I found one that was kind of a template and I changed it. And the more I thought about that though, and the more I went through and just kind of did that process of thinking about the privacy policy, the more I realized that absolutely for most of these types of apps should be out there somewhere. You should link to it somewhere. In Sunlit a week or two ago, I just, you know, I should get a lawyer, you know, don't do what I do. You should get a lawyer and go over the stuff. But I literally just opened I had an old privacy policy in one window and in another text document. I just started writing, basing it loosely on that, but going through all the technical details about how the app works. Like, where does it put photos? Are they private? Are they public? How does it sync? What does it ask for? You know, why does it use Dropbox? How does it use it? Where does it store app.net credentials? Like, just going through all the funny things, because apps like this are complicated. They do a lot of stuff, and you really need to spell it out somewhere. And you'd be as transparent as possible, I think, about what it's doing.
Yeah, you know, even in Marzet, I've never really thought I really strictly need a privacy policy because, you know, the relationship is between a user, Marzet at the software, and the blog service, which is not Red Sweater. So why would I need a privacy policy? But looking at it from a user's point of view, they don't care that I don't happen to be the host of the blog. They may not even completely understand that sometimes. So I think the point of the privacy policy is as much to really hammer down and make crystal clear to users exactly what your involvement is with their data than to necessarily like defend or explain any data storage that you do. So like in my case, it's, you know, making it crystal clear that when you write a blog post in MarsEdit and send it, say, to Blogger as a private post, let's say, exactly what kind of, you know, treatment that data gets, and make it so that users who do care and who are acutely interested in the privacy of their data have a good understanding and can therefore trust you to the extent that you explain what you do. That is directly correlated with how much a user can then trust you.
Yeah, I think it's worth doing. I've definitely come around to, asked me 2 years ago, like, I don't have time for that. I'm not going to hire a lawyer to write something that no one reads. But I've definitely come around to thinking it's a really good idea, even if it's how I approach it, which is kind of a human readable privacy policy, just spelling the stuff out. The other thing I'm trying with Sunlit is I put it on GitHub, the privacy policy. And, you know, it's just a markdown file. It's public. You just link to it. And the idea there is I'm hoping if I have a problem that people can use that mechanism to, you know, you could do a pull request. You could say, you know, this is wrong. Or even if no one takes the time to actually, you know, submit a bug on the privacy policy or fork it and try to fix it, it would still be, there would be a history of changes to it in the public. And so I'm trying that. We'll see how it works. But so far, I like it.
All right, Manton. Well, I have one task for you this week, mm-hmm. which is I want you to look good and hard at that reject binary button in iTunes Connect. And I want you to become one with the button. And I want you to become at peace with not pressing the button.
I need to write a Safari extension that disables any button called reject binary.
Reject button. Are you sure? Are you really, really sure? Next week, I hope to be celebrating the approval and release of Sunlit. And you're not going to make that happen by rejecting the binary.
True. I hope so, too. I hope that I can talk next week about how the launch went.
Yeah, well, I'll be hoping for the best for you, both in terms of your own ability to let the binary fly from the nest and in the willingness of Apple to agree that it's ready to go.
Yep.
And just as a reminder, folks, we are trying to kind of get that listener Q&A back up and going. So it was a fun discussion this week talking about the in-app analytics. If you have other suggestions for us or specific questions, the address is feedback@coreint.org. And of course, also, we welcome those kinds of questions on the Glassboard. It's a great place to get a conversation going about some of these things before we record our thoughts in an episode. So thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week.
Bye.